Hello, hello. Welcome back to On Further Review.
And a happy March Madness to everyone too.
Yeah, right? This is the time of the year. I think there's a commercial going right now that's doing like the most wonderful time of the year song. It upsets my wife because she's like, it's not Christmas, but this is the, in my opinion, this is one of the best, if not the most wonderful times of the year as we enter into March Madness. And just I've used the expression before, but it's college basketball drinking from a fire hydrant instead of a faucet.
It is so good.
Bam, in your face. I mean, right before the tournament, you have all the conference tournaments, which are, winding down. If it's any indication from the conference tournaments of what March Madness, the NCAA tournament is going to be, it's going to be nuts because there have been so many. I think 2 days ago or a couple days ago, there were like seven games decided by 2 points or less. You've got one seeds and two seeds from conferences falling to 8 and 9 seeds kind of on a habitual basis here this year. I'm excited. I know last year was great to have it back after missing a year for the previous year, but this year, full fans back, full motion. Some of the sites will just be rocking. And I think the parity, or at least the level of play, is about as equal as I remember having seen it.
There's a parity, and there's just a new energy of having the fans there too. That's that you can really, really see. You've seen it the entire course of the year too. And then now with the conference tournaments going on, you just see the energy. I'm looking forward to how much that's going to increase in the actual NCAA tournament as well too, to see what that does. But there's a lot. It's interesting to see what the Blue Buds are kind of back this year. And last year they kind of had a down year, but we got Duke and Kentucky and Kansas, even a historical one like Arizona. We've got some of the big powerhouses back on top again. So it should make for a rather great March Madness season. We'll see what happens. All the parity in the league, like you said,
you look at those Blue Bloods being back. I mean, Duke seems to be pretty good. Like you mentioned, Kentucky, Arizona, I consider a Blue Blood from back in the day too. But you also have seen these teams lose to much, much inferior competition. I mean, Arizona is really good, but they kind of rely on shooting lights out. Sometimes, as anybody does, like, you have to make shots, Duke got creamed by North Carolina their final game of the regular season. We've seen, Illinois and Wisconsin go down in the Big Ten tourney. We've seen, some of these teams, just some of them, not be as consistent. So I'm excited. It'll probably, because I'm excited for all these upsets, it'll probably be, very chalky or something, because March Madness is, you can expect the unexpected. So, it'll be opposite of whatever we think it is, but I do think it's going to be kind of wide open. And I could see it being, a case where, number one seeds don't make it to the Final Four type of deal. All that type of thing is in play to me, just because there's not a standalone better than everybody team. I think last year we knew Gonzaga and Baylor were at least a couple notches above everybody else. And I mean, the Zags and Arizona are right there at the top of the standings, but both have shown they're, kind of beatable, or at least they're just not blowing teams out like you'd think of the one and the two seed to do.
Do you think there's a one or two seed that are vulnerable to lose, or which one or two seed is the most vulnerable for a first round exit?
So it'll be interesting to see how they're seeded or what teams are in there. But I would say there's four regions, right? So we're talking one seeds and two seeds. That's eight teams. Yep. I'd be willing to say, depending on the matchups, half of them could be in tight games. That's just how I feel like the way the season's going. I'm not saying all of them will lose, but if you told me out of those eight teams, four of them are going to be in trouble with two to go, I'm not going to be surprised this year. The discrepancy between a one and a 16, shout out to UMBC on that historic win of a 16 seed. But that discrepancy is still usually pretty good. So I'm probably looking more at the 2 seed lines for any like big time major upsets. But I mean, like I follow the Badgers. They lost. They've been looking pretty bad. I think they were on like a 3 or a 4 seed line until recent losses. And they lost to Nebraska, who won 9 games before beating Wisconsin at the end of regular season. So,
and don't forget they lost one of their star players in with Johnny Davis.
He did come back last night or played against Michigan State in the loss in the Big Ten championship Big Ten tournament. But I mean, teams like that, you see teams lose. There was a conference, the MAAC, I think, Mid Atlantic. I'm going to butcher the name of it, but where the number one seed, I think it was Iona. If I remember correctly, Rick Pitino is down there coaching out of coaching purgatory he found himself in. But
well, if it's the Mako League, you know, right next to Jiffy Lube.
Yeah, right. It sounds like exactly. But I mean, he was the number one seed and they lost to a Rider team that finished, I think, 8th or 9th in their conference. And that's a conference where you expect the number one seed team to get in. And also they're probably not going to send more than one team to the tournament anyway. So there's just a lot of that, which makes me think, again, I would be looking at the 2 line without having seen any seeds yet or obviously Selection Sunday coming. I would say I would look for 2 vulnerable 2 seeds. That would be my kind of bold-ish prediction is 2 number 2 seeds to either squeak one out or lose. So if you like on the betting line, I know usually in March Madness, we're all about the brackets. I like looking at the lines and stuff too. And I can guarantee you there'll be at least 2 15 seeds that I bet on the spread thinking that they'll cover.
I think it's always exciting. I think the 2 or 15 seed has been kind of the new 12 over 5 in a way. Just in terms of that, it seems like every year we have someone, we have a team that can come in and knock off a 2 seed. And, Virginia fell that one year. I don't see that happening this year again. We'll see what happens. Obviously a lot can happen, but I'm not sure that'll happen this year, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Again, that's historic for a reason. Even in a year of parity, that's going to be historic, a 16 beating a 1. But that's why I say I look at either the spreads or the 2-15 matchup. Like you said, we've seen actually quite a few of those, it feels like. Probably not as many as it seems in our head, like it happens every year, but I'd say every other year it feels like a 15. I know, I think that was Oral Roberts last year. We were talking right before turning this on that I've always taken off the Thursday afternoon and the Friday opening of March Madness. I think 2 years out of my life do I remember not taking off. One of them being, obviously, a couple years ago we didn't have the tournament, and then last year my son was born and I was trying to save up time for when he was going to be born, and he's at the end of the month he wound up being born, so I didn't take time off last year, but I always do, and I always enjoy kind of saddling up and watching all these games, and now Crosby is gonna have March Madness memories as well. Probably he'll think of them as birthday memories, but you know, all the same.
So, as long as he's happy, right?
Yeah, exactly. But
you know, that's one of the joys of watching this tournament and how much it's really tied to us for some of those memories of watching it with family and things like that. So I got to ask, as you've done this every single year, but two, what are some of your favorite March Madness moments? And when you think of March Madness, what comes to mind in terms of those Cinderella moments or the storylines, the Oral Roberts, the nun from Chicago or things like that?
Yeah, right. Sister Jean Loyola. I like that. Yeah, I think the ones that stand out are the ones that, you know, make a deep run or the Final Four, memories. I personally think for the majority of people, myself, a lot of times we remember the upsets that destroyed our brackets. And I'll never forget the year that I took Michigan State as a on the 2 line to make the make the national championship, and they got beat by your Middle Tennessee State in the first round. I think that was a 2-15. That's one that stands out. As you mentioned, like, I give all the credit to my dad, our father, as far as the as far as our love for college basketball, because I remember him coming home or opening it up and being like, all right, you know, we're all going to sit down and watch this. This is happening now, you know, on a Thursday at noon, and hearing stories from him about, you know, some of the iconic ones like NC State Houston, you know, that was before my time in the national championship, and some of those games, some of the old UCLA teams, you know, in recent memory, you know, you had like the Duke UNLV in 1991, makes me think of, you know, you got the Leitner shot, you've got, you know, some of these that aren't upsets, but maybe more iconic. As far as upsets go, I think of, you know, we did a podcast, you can go back, or an episode, you can go back and watch, I think it was last year, on George Mason, their run. You know, Oral Roberts is now a name from last year. You know, back in the day, people know, I not remember it, but Gonzaga was that. Gonzaga was the Cinderella team, you know, kind of growing up. I remember, you know, we now know Steph Curry with the Warriors. I remember him making a Final Four, Elite Eight, maybe push with Davidson. And we never heard of this kid. And he's just out there getting buckets, beating everybody. You know, there's just a lot of those iconic moments. I remember, what was it? Bryce Drew on Valpo in the corner, in the corner shot. That was one that will always stick in my head, of him hitting that shot. The other one I think of is, I think it was the year after Melo won with Syracuse, they lost to Bucknell. To be 100% honest, a lot of these schools are ones I had never heard of, like weren't even on my radar. And I remember these upsets happening, and immediately like look up whether it was the internet when, you know, that came along, or you tried to figure it out from books or something. But like, where is this located? Like, where is this place at? I remember Bucknell beat Kansas. I apologize. Vermont was the team beat Syracuse. I think that was a 14-3 matchup. But those are the ones that how about you? Those are the ones that come to my mind, like the Vermonts, the Bucknells, the Georgia State from a few years back with that huge three. You know, the Middle Tennessee State bracket buster over Michigan State, you know, obviously last year, the Oral Roberts run, the Davidson run, the George Mason run. I think these teams that, you know, win a couple games are the ones that really cement in my head.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Middle Tennessee State, obviously that's going to have a special place in my heart. Being at the school when that event happened and celebrating with a lot of my fellow Blue Raider fans there. It's because that's the only place you're going to find Blue Raider fans is in Murfreesboro. So at least I was there when that happened.
Yeah. That's awesome to have been there. Right.
You know, it's that one. It's the, I think, was it 1999 or early 2000, Michigan State versus Wisconsin Final Four, where I think Michigan State won or something. I think they won that game. It was early 2000.
Yeah, I think they were. Was that the one they were almost, if I remember correctly, they were like down eight with a couple of minutes left or something.
Had a comeback.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that one's, you know, I remember the big guys from LSU as well too, back, you know, and their improbable run that they had for a few minutes, you know, a few moments there. And that's the thing that's exciting about March Madness is that it's really a matter of just getting hot at the right moment, right?
Yeah.
It's what makes the NFL playoffs so fun as well, too. We just got through that this past, you know, about a month ago, is you can have a team like Cincinnati make it to the Super Bowl because they just, all the pieces come together. And there's normally the blue bloods normally win out the end, which is probably good for the
For the overall sport.
It's good for the overall score, but every once in a while you get a Butler in there, right? You get a Butler to win the national championship or something like that.
Hayward off the rim to almost beat Duke at the buzzer.
You get something like that. But to me, the most, when I think of March Madness, I think of this game in particular, because it summarizes, I think it's such a snapshot of what March Madness is about. And it's the 2006 matchup between Gonzaga and UCLA.
Notarized Sweet 16.
Notarized by Gus Johnson's call, Heartbreak City, where UCLA erases a 17-point deficit against what I thought at the time was the best player in the NCAA that year, in Adam Morrison. And obviously, you know, J.J. Redick, I think, was the co-Wooden Award for that tournament with Duke. And he's had a decent career with the NBA.
Yeah. But going back to – let's hop into it and get back to the 2006 season. If you I don't know if you recall, but SportsCenter, like, led with the J.J. Redick, Adam Morrison feud or scoring battle or National Player of the Year battle almost every single night that college, like the storyline of that college basketball season was who was the better player, JJ Redick or Adam Morrison. And it was, hey, let's check in on Duke. How many did JJ get? Let's check in on Gonzaga. How many did Morrison get? And this, like I mentioned, Gonzaga being a Cinderella team for myself growing up, because that's what they were when Mark Few kind of put them on the map. And he's done an incredible job building that into a national blue blood type of brand. But to me, this was the first year, because of Morrison, because of kind of their cementing, this was the first year where Gonzaga wasn't just like plucky upstart, the bracket buster Cinderella team. This was the year where they were the favorite. Like they were up there because they had this dude, Adam Morrison, with the floppy hair and the very faint, almost penciled on mustache. That was just getting buckets and just dominating teams. And the thing was, you know, this was also the rise of the era where these teams would play a lot of better teams out of conference. So it wasn't just like the West Coast Conference opponents for them. Like Morrison was getting buckets against other ranked teams in, you know, invitationals or tournaments, you know, beginning of the season or mid season. But you're right. Like I remember that debate of almost every single weekend of, would you rather have Redick? Would you rather have Morrison? Not being a Duke guy, I think I was always on Morrison as well. And I don't know. The difficulty of some of his shots, of the shots he could make, as we'll get into in this Sweet 16 matchup against UCLA, was just absolutely just awesome to watch. Like, just an absolute joy to watch this guy play basketball that year.
Yeah. He loved playing basketball. That's the thing I remember about watching him and watching that year, was how much he loved to play the game of basketball. I was what he was here to do, is play basketball. So let's get into the game here. And I want to first open up the comments to see if you have any, so comments on that first, basically the first 19 minutes of the game, or rather the first, I guess it'd be 59 minutes of the game or something like that. The first, you know, up into the final moment of the last quarter, or the last the second half there, because really Gonzaga had their way with UCLA the entire game, almost the entire game, until that final 40 seconds, that final, you know, minute and a half.
Yeah, so they dominate. I mean, the first half of this game is kind of ugly for UCLA. It's ugly both sides. Both teams didn't shoot well to start. A lot of early whistles, a lot of fouls called. I would say, in my opinion, like not a great first half, but Gonzaga gets out to quite a lead. UCLA trailed by 17 in that first half. I know Gus Johnson, which can we just like, even if he's not calling the game, if there's a memorable game, can we just have him like redo the announcing? Because hearing him on any game is just electric. I love anything that Gus Johnson calls. He brings such a passion to the game. And to me, he is the voice of college basketball and always will be for me. But Gus Johnson mentioned that the Bruins, the UCLA Bruins, were looking, quote unquote, shaky. And Len Elmore, who is his counterpart there, said, shaky? I think they should be embarrassed. Not only are they not able to score, they're not even able to hold on to the ball. And that was a snapshot of what that first half looked like. And like you said, the majority of that game, UCLA kind of chips away the lead in the second half. basically what happens is, you know, Morrison might go sit on the bench. UCLA makes a run. Morrison comes back. They extend their lead back. But it's always hanging around like anywhere between 9 to 14 points in Gonzaga's favor. You know, a lot of fouls. I remember thinking, you know, in the first big chunk of that game, a lot of fouls. I think Gonzaga gets into the bonus in the second half with 8 minutes to go. So every common foul, they're shooting free throws, which is a huge advantage, obviously. But yeah, it felt like one of those games where Gonzaga felt in control the entire time. But as they kept trying to, like, you know, stiff arm this UCLA team and extend that lead or give them the dagger, as it were, UCLA just kept hanging around, just kept being pesky. They were physical. Like, that was the thing that struck me. UCLA was not making shots. And as we know, this is expert analysis here. You have to make shots to win basketball games.
You only make the shots with it. That one thing I see on the motivational posters about, you know, you only miss the shots you don't take or something like that.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah.
It reminds me of some of that.
You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Well, they were missing about, I think, 60% of the shots they were taking. So they were having a rough go. I think probably worse, actually. I think they've shot like under 30% in the first half, UCLA. Gonzaga was struggling too, which that's what the entire game felt like. Gonzaga had this thing in the bag. UCLA was, like I said, kept trying to fight, claw to get it under 10, to get it under, you know, overcome the 17 point lead, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. That's my, I don't know what you thought as you rewatched it. My biggest takeaway was like UCLA was kind of trying to rough them up a little bit and play tough. But just seemed outmatched, for the vast majority of this, for the first half for sure. And even, most of the way through the second half.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it as, okay, Adam Morrison is putting the JJ Redick, Adam Morrison debate to bed in the first half. That was because he just seemed to be completely on fire, in control of the game. That's what I saw. And then as the game drew closer to an end, what I saw is that somehow we can talk about the miraculous last minute and a half. We'll get there. But everything had to go right for UCLA to be able to erase that 17 point deficit. And it seemed like everything had to go wrong for Gonzaga for that to happen too. And if one of those three things didn't happen, we're looking at a very different outcome for that, that iconic game.
Yeah. As I mentioned, like with 8 minutes to go in the game, you know, that Gonzaga's up 9, I think, at that point, like just 8 and 8.5 minutes. They're now in the bonus, so every common foul, they're shooting free throws. I mean, those things are all, like, stacked in Gonzaga's favor and obviously stacked against UCLA. You know, UCLA in the second half starts shooting a little better, but still, you know, Morrison's getting buckets. I think that same weekend, Redick had gone, like, 3 for 17 and Duke had lost. So this really, like you said, like you pointed out, this is really the game where we're like, okay, like, Morrison's dropping 20 plus. Redick struggled and got bounced. Like, this is going to put it to bed. This is going to kind of solidify in most people's mind who the best player in college basketball was that year.
Yeah.
But UCLA was, like I said, physical. They had a dog mentality for sure. Even down all that, even up against it with the foul trouble. And like you said, Gonzaga just kind of had everything go wrong. And had a lot go wrong to not be up like 20 and this thing be out of hand.
Yeah, I mean, they're thinking about they're up 17. Like, that's a pretty good lead, especially, you know, that's a lot of points to overcome right there.
The thing that struck me on the rewatch, I remember vaguely how I felt about it watching it live, and that was that Gonzaga was firmly in control of this game. On the rewatch, with the benefit of knowing how it ends, I was struck with just how UCLA didn't seem like they thought this thing was out, gone. You know, like, I think everybody else did. Yeah. You saw the fight in them. Guys like Luke Mbamute, guys like Jordan Farmar, guys like Aaron Aflalo. There's a play with, I think, about 7 left to go, Aaron Aflalo gets fouled on his way to the hoop by Morrison. They kind of get tangled up, shoulders and arms, you know, that type of thing. And rather than just get untangled, Aflalo just like shrugs and shoves Morrison off, and he hits the ground. And he just kind of like looks back on him and then starts walking back to the free throw line. And that, I paused and rewatched that probably 3 times just to look at Aflalo's face. And that's what I saw that I did not see on the live watch of it, or maybe even rewatches previous, was a disdain of like, we like, get off me, man. Like we got this. And they're down 9 at the time, or I think maybe, I think he cut it to 9 with the free throws. Like they're losing, they're not winning. And he just had the mentality of like, we're equals. Like you're the, you know, one of the top 2 players in the league, but tonight we're equals. Like I don't bring this to me. Like you're better than me. And it was just that mentality. Yeah, it was. And I think Ben Holland, the UCLA coach at the time, has been known and shown for a lot of his coaching career that that's kind of what he brings. It's like that dog mentality. You saw it on the UCLA players, even though the scoreboard didn't reflect it for this game.
Yeah, a lot of it too. I mean, we talk about the, you know, beliefs and things like that, right? We talk about, you know, One Shiny Moment is one of the iconic songs that they play for March Madness, right? There's different there's different things like that. But a lot of it comes down to that belief of okay, you know what? Anything can happen. It's not just a belief in yourself, even though it's part of it, but a belief that, you know, the ball can bounce different ways. And if it bounces your way, you know, you might get luck, you might get a shot.
Yeah.
So speaking of the basketball bouncing Gonzaga's way, we there's that iconic moment in the last minute and a half, or really 40, ball down to 40 seconds.
Yeah.
Starting with the inbound pass from Gonzaga that's stolen. And then I think it's the freshman who goes inside and gets the easy dunk right there.
Yeah. So with under a minute to play, Jordan Farmar, who I mentioned, hits a pretty tough floater, running floater, cuts it to a 3-point game at that point. UCLA had clawed all the way back, or at least, you know, within shot. Morrison then goes down on the other end and misses a tough fadeaway, which he'd been kind of, you know, so-so. They just made him work for it. You know, like I keep bringing back, like they really tried to rough up Morrison. I think that was part of their game plan. And on the miss fadeaway from Morrison, Batista, their big Gonzaga's big man, fouls on the rebound. So, I think at that point it's a 3-point game. So I think it's 71-68 and UCLA's headed to the line, type of thing. They make both free throws and now it's a 1-point game. And I think it's 19.7 seconds left. After those free throws, and that's when the insanity ensues.
Yeah, that's when the inbound the pass gets stolen. I think they said that in the final 5 possessions in those moments for Gonzaga were all turnovers. They turned the ball over 5, or maybe they turned the ball over 5 times in the last, you know, 19 seconds or something like that. They just just a complete collapse of the Gonzaga team.
So they poke it out of Batista's hand. You know, they're obviously running trap down 1:19 seconds left. They trap Batista, poke it out, and then just a thread the needle type pass to Umba Mute for a layup. Mm-hmm. And that gives them the 72-71 lead with 8.6 seconds left. And I'm looking at my notes right now, you know, looking at some of these details, and I'm getting goosebumps because I could hear that arena. I could hear Gus Johnson losing his mind. And just the pandemonium of everybody traps at the end of the game, but every time it works, it feels like, what is going on? Like
it
unbelievable.
Does,
and for good reason. Usually the offensive play is more favored in rules. It's, you know, it's easier to play offense a lot of times than it is to defend. And for that trap to work, to poke it out from behind him as Batista has the ball above his head. I think it was Farmar pokes it out from behind as they double team him. And then,
yeah,
and then Batista's right there in front of him, a much bigger man. And that pass he threads almost at the rim to Umba Mute. He catches it, lands, lays it up, 72-71, 8.6 seconds left. First time all game UCLA's led. And here we are, you know.
Yeah. And you see the collapse of Gonzaga that's etched on the face of Adam Morrison. And, you know, and you feel bad for the guy too. At the time, you know, yeah. I didn't feel that bad, but you feel bad for the guy. His tears run down his face. He collapses into the under the floor, you know, jersey pulled over the head, that type of, you know, the surrender Cobra look.
Well, because even with 8.6 seconds left, right, they've got a chance. They got the number two guy in the league. They get a nice inbounds pass. They're not trapped in the corner like they did the last possession. The point guard, Ravio, is bringing it up the floor. And Umba Mute, this is the thing that kind of stood out to me. He's a freshman. Instead of celebrating his go-ahead bucket, 8.6 seconds left, he has the wherewithal to track the guard back down, pokes it out from behind him, recovers it, there's a foul, obviously, that ensues. Yeah. With 1.9 seconds left.
Yeah.
So you still had that chance with Gonzaga. Then after that foul, UCLA misses the first free throw. So it's going to be a 2-point game.
Yeah.
Cause he sinks the next free throw and it's 73-71. And then on top of it, just all the emotions of these final seconds, they get a good inbounds pass. Three quarters of the court, Gonzaga does, into Batista's hand. He's just inside the arc, gets the shot off. Like, all these things are like best case scenarios for Gonzaga after a full melt. And obviously it goes off the backboard. I mean, Gus Johnson just lets the play go and the atmosphere go and says, Batista with the catch. And then obviously he misses it. And as you mentioned, it pans even before when they poke the ball out and get fouled up one, UCLA, that is, Morrison's already in tears. Like, this dude has grind and sweat and like given his all for this team all year in this game. I think he winds up ending with like 24 points or something in this game. And honestly, like, he's the one that makes the pass to Batista, Morrison, that is, who then gets trapped and turns it over, which leads UCLA lead. But he never gets the ball. Like, after that pass, Morrison never gets to touch the ball again because the inbounds pass, the guard gets it stolen. Even the length of the court, obviously they're double teaming him, so it goes to Batista. But the thing that was interesting to me is we know the scene of him crumpled on the floor as the final buzzer sounds. But even in that 1.9 seconds when they foul and UCLA is going to the line, his tear, like the tears are already flowing, like, as he knows, he knows just what they gave up.
Yeah. I mean, that was, one of the greatest Gonzaga teams to ever, to ever run out onto the court. Obviously before the championship run they just had and with Mark Few, but
this was their best chance at a national championship.
This was their moment. This was their one moment to make this happen. And think about being up by 17, thinking that, this moment's here. We're going to go to our second Elite Eight, first under, the first one under Mark Few or something like that, too. It's just to think, okay, it's here. We're in this moment. We're here. Let's do this. And up 17, think it's right there. And all of a sudden, it all crashes down on you. I think it's just absolutely, you can't imagine the heartbreak after all that, to know that, it's just incredible to think. Yeah. And I can't blame the guy either. Cannot blame the guy for that, but it made for an iconic call with Gus Johnson.
Absolutely.
The heartbreak city. And you felt the emotion of the game right there. You felt like you were right there in the arena. You felt like you were right there next to Adam Morrison.
Yeah,
watching his tears at the same time, watching the jubilation of, Jordan Farmar and and all the guys from UCLA too. And to know that it could have been them on the other side of it too, if that last bucket goes in, or if one of those steals didn't happen, when the turnovers didn't happen in the final 20 seconds, it could have been a whole different scenario.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me because you see him crumple there. You hear the call, Heartbreak City, from Gus Johnson. Obviously heartbreak, but also exhaustion from how hard Morrison worked for that game. Which leads me to a question for you, because I think even today Gonzaga kind of gets labeled as this team, even the teams they put out on the court that have made national championships. They lost in 16-17 to UNC. They lost last year, obviously, to Baylor. I don't know what your take is on it, but it definitely seems, at least to me, like there's still this idea that, like, Gonzaga, as good as they are and as good as the teams they have that get out there, they can kind of get punked or bullied a little bit. And I don't know that that's fully the story of what happened here in 06. But obviously obviously UCLA was very physical. The foul discrepancy shows that. Even just watching the game play out, you can see it's amazing to me to watch. This is 2006, which doesn't feel like that long ago, but is.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah.
But spacing in basketball is just so completely different now, and kind of wide open offensive sets. Whereas this is just like muddled in the middle of the paint. Everybody's in there. Good luck driving to the hoop. There's almost always contact going to the hoop. There's the cuts and stuff that we know today, the wide open 3-point lines. Or just the defense of the 3-point line has opened up the middle of the court, but there was just all this physicality. And it does feel like, I know I'm recency biased with Baylor's win last year, but Baylor beat Gonzaga just by kind of being physical with them as well. I don't know what your take is on, Gonzaga's this team that comes from this, lesser conference of quality of play, where they rack up wins in the regular season. I think they're a good team. I think Mark Few's a hell of a coach. But it does seem like in these tournaments sometimes that they get, when they meet a team that's just gonna kind of punk, schoolyard bully these Gonzaga teams, that sometimes they, in this case, that's in my opinion what UCLA did to make this just improbable comeback turn into Heartbreak City for Gonzaga.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've ever really thought about Gonzaga specifically in terms of being a finesse or a more of a power team or a physical team. But I do think you make a good point. You have those teams in the tournament that can make, they can make a fairly deep run based on, they have their, if they're finesse, they have a good shooter. Think of Davidson when they had, like I mentioned, Steph Curry and Davidson, they made a decent run there. Because they had Steph Curry, who could knock those jumpers down, or even a team like mentioned Middle Tennessee State over Michigan State, right? And really, what that was Middle Tennessee State outshot and was able to finesse their way to a pretty easy victory right there. But with that being said, those teams generally don't make it all the way to the championship. I think there's always something that happens and it normally doesn't go all with the championship. So I think it's interesting. And it's maybe it's a matter of consistency. Maybe the ones that win are those that can shoot, but also can be physical. And you saw that a little bit with UCLA in that moment. That could, they definitely could shoot, but they also could be physical as well too. And maybe it's the teams that can do both in a balance, maybe not both well, but both balance are the ones that can make it and cut down the nets at the end of the year.
Yeah, I do. I think your team has to have a little bit of both. It has to have a little dog and physicality. And obviously, as we've talked about, you have to make shots. And I think especially when you're talking about a tournament where you have to win 6 games in a row, many times against very good opponents, at least we'll say at the minimum 4 out of those 6 games are against very good opponents. That's where you shine through. It's a war of attrition. It's last man standing in March Madness. And I'd say most of the time we do get, one of the best teams winning it all. But sometimes in the one and done type of setup of this tournament, you you get obviously all the upsets, but you get people that just muck it up enough against a team that's better and hit enough shots. I think, you know, a lot of the upsets have that in common where they, the lower seed might just kind of make it a little more of a grind. But on top of that, be able to hit shots. And I think you have to do both to win. I'm not anti Zags or Mark Few. I hope that they get over that hurdle. They've had he's had such an incredible run with them, coaching them and building that brand really. It's funny to me. I talk about building brands. One of the things that stood out of this rewatch of 2006 is the jerseys. Like I think kids now like get or sized up for their jersey.
Yeah.
This is still in the era of like grab it off the rack. Like the guy that just graduated left it for you and we washed it, but you can wear it anyways. I mean, we got like t-shirt game on point underneath the jerseys for you know, Morrison and I think Darren Collison, you know, just kind of baggy clothes. Whereas now it's all like form fitted Nike, Adidas, Reebok, like all these brands have kind of perfected or cleaned up the look, but I still am a little partial. That's just my nostalgia probably to the baggy YMCA looking jerseys hanging off the shoulders. But
it's better than the early 80s and 90s when you're basically wearing, you know, boxers as shorts. Yeah,
I'm forever grateful to the Fab Five for cleaning up the shorts.
For helping us out.
Yeah. Nobody needs to. Larry Bird's amazing, but it's tough to watch his hands when you're just looking at his thighs. One quick note on this tournament in specific. I think 2006, we've now done two podcasts. If you want to go back on the episode we did of last year of George Mason's Final Four run, this might be a contender for one of the most Cinderella tournaments of all time. None of the top seeds, none of the number one seeds made the Final Four this year. You mentioned LSU's Big Baby Davis team. They're the ones that knocked off J.J. Redick and Duke and made the Final Four. UConn lost to Cinderella George Mason, as we talked about in that episode. Memphis loses to this UCLA team in the next round. And Villanova, the number one seed, loses to eventual champion Joakim Noah, Al Horford, Florida Gators. So all those teams that upset the number one team actually meet in the Final Four, which is kind of cool. But if you look back, if you just want in prep for this season, just type in your search bar 2006 March Madness, and I think you're going to have a few options for videos of upsets and remarkable upsets in like the George Mason, the LSU. And this UCLA run, as well as, you know, if you're a Gator fan, we live in that first national championship of that team as well. Just an incredible season of March Madness. And this game, as you mentioned, in my personal history, this is the most electrifying March Madness tournament game I've ever seen. I've ever watched live because of how it felt. And because of how it ended, because it was pretty much in hand for Gonzaga all the way up until the final minute. Because the trap in the corner worked, because the pass to the rim worked, because of Morrison crumbling in tears on the court. Like, this is high drama. Like, this is what I want out of every March Madness.
This is what March Madness is all about, right? We want those games. No one likes a March Madness game that's won like by 10 points. Like, those are like, no one likes those. Like, even if you're a fan of the team that's winning, I don't know. Even if, you know, even if Middle Tennessee State is winning and they're winning by 10, or the Badgers are winning by 10, you know, I'd much rather prefer watching those final couple seconds of the game and seeing that buzzer beater either go in or bounce out, and see the, you know, that's the moments that's why I watch March Madness, right?
Yeah. It's for that team with the last shot down one or two. And that ball in the air is going to determine it one way or the other. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But the cool thing though, too, is to go full, you know, bring it back into the more closer time to the 21st century. I think it was last year, I believe it was, UCLA versus Gonzaga.
And oh, yeah.
Adam Morrison had the call for the Gonzaga when they beat UCLA with that last minute, buzzer beater there to win the game and go to the national championship. So kind of cool that it came full circle.
Yeah, Morrison was on the call.
He was on the call for the Gonzaga broadcast when Suggs made that winning shot. So
that's awesome.
Adam Morrison, I was hopeful that he was gonna say Heartbreak City and run it back, but he didn't. He was a bigger man, I guess. But
yeah, just fully all the way around. That's awesome that he was on that call for that shot from Suggs.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. And then it turned out well for him too. Obviously, you know, heartbreak right then, but for him to see his Zags get back to national championship, I'm sure it was special for him too. So,
yeah. And we'll see this year. They're up there as one of the favorites. They will probably be the number one overall seed this year. It's right there again for Gonzaga to try to get that first trophy of the first tournament. Championship, the first national championship for Gonzaga. But this is an incredible. The full game is on YouTube. I know we say that a lot with most of these things that we rewatch. But it's 1,000% worth a rewatch for you if you remember this game.
Really,
if you don't remember this game, especially go back and watch what we're talking about, because this is an iconic March Madness moment.
Yeah, one of those moments that define what March Madness is really all about. Like you said, this is a snapshot, one game, a snapshot of what March Madness is all about. So,
yep. Heartbreak City for one, unbridled joy for another. That's the drama of the tournament that we love to watch.
Yes, and if you can be so lucky as my brother here too to have a son born around March Madness, you can take time off for this period. You know,
yeah.
I'm not unconvinced it wasn't planned that way, but
it may have been. Yeah.
Either way, enjoy your days off. You know, that those first couple of days, that's one of my favorite times too. That first Thursday through Saturday, Sunday, the first two rounds of it is just, man, I can't believe it's
32 games from noon Eastern on Thursday and Friday, 32 games. Like that's all you need to know. Just saddle up. I never have enough screens in my house to try to build a wall of, of television to be able to see everything going on at once. But I love this time of year. I'm so glad we have the tournament back. I'm so glad we have fans, back and especially this year, as we talked about the start with the parody. I'm excited for just chaos. I hope for chaos.
Mm-hmm. That's what we can bet. That's what we can hope for. Happy betting if you're going to bet on the games. Hope your brackets do well, at least for the first couple rounds, and then we can all use them as fire fodder by the time Monday rolls around.
Yeah, they make good Kindle Friday.
Yeah,